You may have noticed that Adam has chosen a lot of songs that have to do with faith or trust. And we have this conundrum in English. We talk about believing people or having faith in people or God or trust. And it seems to me of these three options that we have, at least in English, that trust conveys a much deeper level of commitment, even conjures up the notion of a relationship. I mean, I might meet the biggest liar in the world and he make a statement and I might believe him, at least in regard to that one statement, but I would not trust him. And faith is almost a word we don't use at all except in a religious context or sometimes talking about, you know, I got faith in, you know, some sports celebrity to, you know, win the game for us or something. But really it's reserved more often for religious activity, and almost because in the broader religious world, we have this almost mystical understanding of what faith is. You know, it's some weird thing we don't really get, and so we have to have a special word for it. But I think if we look at the word trust, that really conveys most closely what the Bible most often means by this. And help us to understand something, because when you talk about faith, the way a lot of people think of faith is you either have faith or you don't have faith. It's like a light switch. You flip it on, the lights are on. You flip it off, the lights are off. You have faith, you don't have faith. And so there are a lot of passages in the Bible, like in Numbers chapter 20, you may remember when Moses strikes the rock and he's a little bit peeved. And we got to bring you water. And God indicts Moses and Aaron and he says, "You did not believe in me." Well, what do you mean? Surely Moses and Aaron, after all this time, knew that God existed and he's the one true God and all of that. So in what sense did they not have faith? Well, again, it's not you have it or don't have it. That's the only two options. They have a kind of faith. It's not perfect. And so they failed in their faith. And that's generally what we think of when we say to someone, "You didn't trust me." Well, you might trust me about some things, but you didn't trust me completely. There's something that failed, at least in this one area. And my favorite story that illustrates this principle, of course, is that anguished father who comes to Jesus in Mark chapter 9. His child's demon-possessed, and the disciples have failed to cast it out. How's that for bragging about who's greatest in the kingdom of God? "And if you can," he says to Jesus, pleading in his desperation, Jesus says, "If I can," you know, all things are possible to the one who believes, the one who has faith, the one who trusts. And he makes that confession, "I do trust, but help my distrust. I do believe, help my unbelief." And that's where I think all of us are. I think the fact that we're here and showing interest in spiritual things says we have faith. But none of us would stand up and say, "I've attained to perfect faith and trust in God." We're all in that category of struggling, as Brian said as he was leading us in prayer. And so we all need to do better in growing in our faith, increasing in our faith, that prayer might be our own prayer. We do believe. But one of the very reasons we come here together to be an encouragement to one another and study the scriptures and to pray and worship God is that our faith might grow. And it's just like the one song said, that as our faith increases, so our hope increases. There's an unbreakable connection between the strength of our trust and the strength of the hope that we have. And if we find that our hope is weak, the only solution is to strengthen our faith and trust in God. Well, if you're going to talk about faith, naturally Hebrews chapter 11 comes to mind. That's where we'll spend the bulk of our time this morning, if you want to be turning there. And while you're doing that, I'll just say we have a number of visitors with us. We're grateful for that. And it's always an occasion to be together with God's people and to keep our eye on what is the most important thing. We're not here to impress anybody. We're not here to put on a show for one another. We're here to grow in our faith. Because there is something, when we came in the door this morning, there's something in my life that is not what God would have it to be. And my prayer, anytime I get up and teach a class in front of anyone, preach a sermon, is that God in His providence might use the message, because it's His message after all. Hopefully, these are the words of God and not the words of Tom. And use those words to help us all grow. And so what can Hebrews 11 help us to understand about faith? Well, it's often been called the Hall of Faith as a takeoff on Hall of Fame. And not to bash people who say that. I mean, I have on occasion said that in the past. But is that really what's happening here? And I think sometimes we lapse into this kind of mistaken approach when we teach, especially little kids, Bible classes, where the hero of the story always turns out to be David or Moses or, you know, Josiah, some other character. And the hero, of course, is always God. It's always about God. And yet there are people who had extraordinary experiences in life and showed extraordinary faith on occasion and rose to that occasion. And we read of many of these cataloged for us in Hebrews chapter 11. But is it really a catalog of the heroes of faith? And I don't think so, for a number of reasons. First of all, why does the writer focus so much on defining what faith is? And it doesn't define faith simply by saying, well, look at Abraham. That's faith in action right there. That's my definition of faith. Now, he interrupts the flow of the telling of these different historical characters to give us some commentary on what faith or trust is. And secondly, why does he focus so much on God and the things that are invisible, the things that cannot be seen? And as we read through this, just note and look for that, these occasions where he pauses to define what trust really is and how it works, and the number of times that he refers to God and what cannot be seen. Thirdly, why include these marginal characters, I guess we could call them, people at least that are not known for having robust faith, that as you consider their story as it's recorded in the Bible, wouldn't rise to the top of anybody's list in talking about faith. Jephthah? I mean, about the only thing he's known for or remembered for is making a rash vow, and his daughter comes out of the house, and she's the victim of his vow that he's taken. Is he our great hero of faith? Now, certainly there are others that are quite different than that, but why would he even be included? And then, why include a bunch of anonymous people? You don't mention them by name. Well, because it's not the people that are important. That's the thing I want us to understand. And then the last thing is, why include a number of defeats and failures? Now, I put them in quotation marks because they're not true defeats, they're not true failures. We understand, but why mention that? What's the point? And so I would suggest to you that what we have here is a demonstration of what trust makes possible, that it's not so much a catalog of people, and these are people of extraordinary faith, but rather it's a catalog of actions that faith is able to take. And it's those actions that are particularly important. Look what faith can do. Look what trust in God can do. And it's not really about what the people do as much as it is about what God is capable of doing with those people. Now, again, I don't want to minimize that people stepped up and they endured persecution and they obeyed the command of God even when it was not easy. But if we think for one moment, that puts the focus on them and detracts from the glory of God and that it is truly His power, well, that's what trust is all about. To talk about trust is to take the focus and emphasis off of the person and put it where it is, which is on God. And so what we have are a series of people who, on occasion, put their focus on God, and that trust in God enabled them to do extraordinary things. Now, in the end, what happens to them? Well, the Bible gives us some divine commentary of what their eternal lot is, but some of them, we really don't know. Jephthah is... Does his appearance in this chapter guarantee that he's going to go to heaven? or these anonymous people that are mentioned, that necessarily means that's what the end result is going to be for them. So look here in Hebrews chapter 11. And again, look for these things as we work our way through the text. And so we get a definition of faith just in the very first verse. Now, faith or trust is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. There again, what cannot be seen. And this brings up the same point that Paul makes in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7. The human plight is to walk by trust and not by sight. And so it's not this kind of reliance upon the physical senses of what we can touch, what we can see, what we can hear, you know, what we could conduct experiments on in a scientific laboratory. But this is a kind of knowledge that goes beyond the empirical data, the sensory perception that we have around us. And so trust is the assurance of things hoped for, not yet realized, the conviction of things that you cannot see. Doesn't mean there isn't any evidence for them. That's just gullibility, not true trust. But there is evidence, but it still cannot be seen directly. And for by it the men of old gained approval or were commended. Well, the implication there, of course, is they were commended by God. By faith, by trust, we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things which are visible. And we have yet to get to an indicator of a historical person who exhibited faith, but finally we do now in verse 4, by faith Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts, and through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. And so here is, what can faith do? What can trust do? Well, it was able to do extraordinary things in the life of Abel, but you see, the effect of trust, even after Abel is dead and gone, is this is what the work of trust can do. It still carries on its effect, even after the person who did the trusting is dead and gone. And you might even say, no longer trusting. He's no longer in the trusting business, wherever he is. And by faith, Enoch was taken up, so he would not see death. And he was not found because God took him up, for he obtained the witness that before his being taken up, he was pleasing to God. So again, God commends the trust that Enoch had. God commends the trust that Abel had. And yet Abel was killed. So if we think trust is some kind of arrangement with God where everything's going to work out well in my life and nothing bad is ever going to happen, well, that's not what it is. This is one of those defeats that's going to become very prominent at the end of the chapter because bad things happen to people of faith. But that doesn't change the nature of faith, and it doesn't change the possibility of what actions of faith or what trust is capable of doing in our life. So verse 6, he pauses again and says, without trust, it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must trust that he is and that he's a rewarder of those who seek him. So again, we've digressed from talking about people, but we're going to talk about the nature of trust a little bit more. It is impossible to please God. You will not be commended or labeled as pleasing to God without trust. And then by trust, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness that is according to faith. And having completed that patriarchal period, he then turns his attention to Abraham as a significant character in the history of Israel about faith, the father of faith. By trust, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place where he was to receive an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. And I just often wondered what that conversation with Sarah was like. Well, honey, it's time to pack and move. Well, where are we going? I have no idea. And some God you've never heard of says, he'll tell us when we get there. Boy, she had to be a pretty trusting woman herself. And so he acts in trust. And by trust, he lived as an alien, a sojourner in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. Again, it doesn't mention God by name in verse 9, but that promise, of course, is the promise that God made, and that's what lies behind all of this. And he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Again, you get this little bit of a digression here to explain to us what's really going on when we talk about this kind of trust. It's not a city that can be seen. It's not a city that's made by human hands. It's God's city. And even Sarah, by faith, herself received ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. I mean, as far as walking by sight and anything you can act upon empirical data, her body's just kaput. I mean, she was probably barren when she was in her 20s. They had not had any children at all. And then all the way up till Abraham, 75 years old, hadn't had any children. Surely, if we're going to have any kids, we'd have had some by now. And God says, you're going to have a child. And through a series of twists and turns, God finally explains to him, no, it's going to be your own child and Sarah's child. And by this time, of course, he's approaching 100. And she's approaching 90. Really? But she trusted. And he trusted. And so it says about him in verse 12, therefore, there was born even of one man, and him as good as dead at that, as many seed as the stars of the heaven in number, and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. And having mentioned these up through Abraham and broadcasting the fact that Abraham is going to have many seed according to the promise of God, he then goes on another one of these digressions before he resumes talking about Abraham in verse 17. He says, all these died in faith, having without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance. But they didn't see them with a physical eye. That's part of those unseen, invisible things. But faith is what enables you to see them. And they saw them even at that from a distance. And having confessed, they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear they're seeking a country of their own. Indeed, if they'd been thinking of the country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. What can faith do? What can I do if I have that kind of trust in God? And then the question really is, what can God do with me if I could just bring myself to trust him? To say, well, it's really not about me, God. It is you and your purpose and your promises. And whatever it is you want me to do, you have given me sufficient strength, sufficient resources to do that. And I simply need to find the resolve, the courage to overcome my fear and allow my trust in God to be what's more important than my trust in everything else. And so by trust, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was offering up his only son, the very son to whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. Well, you talk about a conundrum of faith. God had made this promise. You're finally going to have a child. He was finally born. Now kill him. But this is the child you said through whom all these other offspring are going to come. How's that going to happen? Dead people don't have... Oh, wait a minute. I guess we did. You know, so Isaac could be dead and still have kids somehow. How's that going to work? Well, he considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which also he received him back as a type. In some sense, he figured out in his head, well, God's got to bring you back somehow. Don't know exactly how that's going to work, but he trusted God. And by trust, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding things to come. Again, things unseen, things invisible, things not yet here. And by similar trust, Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worship on the top of his stick. Of all the things Jacob did. Now, most of the things Jacob did that we know about, you couldn't put in this chapter. By faith, Jacob lied through his teeth, and he did that 50 more times, you know. But he did some things in faith, but out of all of those, as he was dying, he was passing a blessing down to the sons of Joseph. And by faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. And then we come to Moses, and we get a little bit of attention to him, as significant as he is in the history of Israel. So, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents. You know, we've noted this passage before, quite literally his fathers. And it's an indicator that the word father is sometimes used in a more generic sense for parent. And that may very well be, like in Ephesians chapter 6, you know, fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath. It may not be fathers specifically. Mothers are incapable of provoking their children to wrath. But parents, right? Because I think it's pretty clear it was his mother and his father that hid him. It wasn't Moses' father and grandfather and great-grandfather working in collusion. But he's hidden by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child. Doesn't every parent, you know, oh, he's so beautiful. You think the Nile would be filled with baskets of babies, you know. But I think what this word really means, and it comes through more clearly in Acts chapter 7 and verse 20 with Stephen's speech, there's something unique about this child. And Stephen explicitly says unique to God, or beautiful to God. And that is, he's destined for some particular purpose. And it indicates that they did act in faith, and that suggests they knew something about God's purpose. And there was something special about this child, and so it was their faith, not Moses' own faith, that put him in the basket in the Nile, but they did act in that kind of faith. And they were not afraid of the king's edict. And by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Considering the reproach of the Messiah greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. That's one of the most extraordinary claims made in all the New Testament, that Moses acted on his understanding and trust about the Messiah. Now, how much he could have known about the Messiah? Probably didn't know it would be Jesus of Nazareth and so on. But he knew something about God's purpose. That one who would be born of woman, that one who would be born of the line of Abraham, the one who would be born of the line of Judah, that God was going to use to accomplish his great purpose. And so he did what he did because of his trust in the promises of God that would be realized in Christ. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. By faith, he kept a Passover and the sprinkling of the blood so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them. And by faith, they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land, and the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned. And now, again, we're back to a whole group of people. It just they had this trust in God as they passed through, yes, under the leadership of Moses, but it wasn't his faith, it was the faith of the people. Now, there's, again, a whole generation of people. You'd think, I would not hold up the people that came out of Egypt as paragons of faith. Grumbling and complaining and whining and kicking and screaming the whole way from the moment they were leaving Egypt. Even on the shores of the Red Sea. Oh, you just brought us out here to die, Moses. There's great faith. But it did take great faith to put your foot in front of the other and walk through those walls of water. And they may have failed in their faith on so many other occasions, but look what faith could do, even for those people who weren't very good at it. And they weren't very constant at it. But that's what faith can do. And if you understand faith can do that in a circumstance like that, it can also work under other circumstances if we would keep at it. I do believe. Help my unbelief. That's the problem. And so by faith, the walls of Jericho fell after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. And this brings us to the end of our kind of historical catalog of people, but really a demonstration of what faith in their life was able to accomplish. And he says, "What more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, and Samuel, and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight." Now those are all those great victorious kind of things we like to think about. Oh, you know, being thrown in a lion's den and escaping, or being put in a fiery furnace and escaping. That's what faith does. Well, yeah, it can. You can escape the edge of the sword by faith. But sometimes faith brings you to the edge of a sword. And you start seeing that turn here because women receive back their dead by resurrection. Well, it's good that they got resurrected, but why did they die to begin with? But then others were tortured, not accepting their release so they might obtain a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with a sword. They went about in sheepskins, goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world is not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. And all these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised, because God had provided something better for us, that apart from us they would not be made perfect. And so what is our conclusion after we hear all of this history that the writer has gone through? And I think the purpose of it all is to direct our attention back to God and His purpose and His promises. And again, that doesn't necessarily mean they're always going to work out victoriously for us in this life, because there's something bigger. There's a city that's not made by hands. There is a heavenly country that we aspire to. And so our plight here physically doesn't really matter, as long as on the other side of that, there is the victory, and there is the great accomplishment of God's purpose. And that's what, again, can't be seen. You know, we see deliverance and victory when we don't die, and we're delivered out of the lion's den or the fiery furnace. But again, that's to make the mistake of only looking at what your eyes can see. God delivers His people out of every lion's den and every fiery furnace. But some will be delivered by allowing them to burn or allowing them to be consumed by the lions. But they're delivered just as surely. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego understood that. The Lord's going to deliver us. We might burn, but He's going to deliver us. Because that's what faith is all about. Because it's ultimately about God and what God is able to do with us if we will but put our trust in Him and not in ourselves. What can trust do? And so, although it's fine to have a Bible class and study about people of faith and heroes of faith, and talk about the fact they were under extraordinary circumstances and came through and had extraordinary faith on occasion, we never want to lose sight, first and foremost, that God is the true hero. And the fact that all of these people that he's mentioned, that we know really anything about, made mistakes. You know, Abraham failed in his faith just about as often as he succeeded in his faith. And Moses certainly failed in his faith. Jacob certainly did. None of them are perfect like Jesus is perfect. And that's why when he gets to the end of this, with this worst chapter division ever, what he holds up before us is not, oh, look to Abraham and be like Abraham. Or look to Moses and be like Moses, but rather look to Jesus, because he's the only true example that we can hold up about faith. And so therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, people who with firsthand experience know what faith is able to do and what failure of faith is able to do, because we have all of these witnesses, let us also lay aside every encumbrance, the sin that so easily entangles us. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. How do we do that? Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the beginning and end of faith. Now, people can debate what that specific phrase means. I take it to mean that if you look in God's dictionary under faith or trust, there's a picture of Jesus. From the beginning of our understanding of what trust is to the end of it, it's Jesus. And you look to Jesus, you see the perfect demonstration of that kind of trust. Who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so you will not grow weary and lose heart. So you will not fail in your faith. You will continue to have this trust in God and grow in this trust in God. And what will that trust be capable of doing? And so Jesus is the ultimate demonstration of trust, and we should never forget that. And it's sometimes hard for us to wrap our mind around that, because if he's God, and God knows everything, and God's perfect, how can he be tempted? How can he really live by faith as we understand that? And while that may be difficult for us to wrap our mind around, the scriptures are really clear that Jesus lived his life by faith. The Hebrew writer quotes this passage from Isaiah chapter 8 in Hebrews the second chapter in verse 13. I will put my trust in him. I will wait upon the Lord is how it is put in the Hebrew in Isaiah chapter 8. But that is an idiom for trusting God, wait on God, trust in God. And that's part of what it is to be a human. If he truly came to be a human and he truly experienced the human condition, he was walking by trust and not by sight. Now, how does that mesh with his deity? I don't know. Because the problem is what we think we know about God and what we think we know about people don't go together. But they did in Jesus. That's the affirmation of Scripture. And that is that he lived by trust. Now, his trust was perfect. He did not sin. But there is something almost comical of the notion that Jesus comes along pretending to be human and looking over his shoulder saying, okay, fellas, you follow me. And we all get on our little tricycles and we're just pedaling as hard as we can to follow Jesus. And he goes roaring off on his motorcycle, cackling. Yeah, follow me. I can't. But Jesus rode a tricycle too. He lived by faith, just as we're called to live by faith. But what was extraordinary about it is he had a perfect faith. Because that's what trust can do as well. That wasn't a miracle. That was his trust. And I think this is what really explains a lot of the stories that the Hebrew writer uses throughout here. Abel, he's the first righteous sufferer. He's the one who makes the right kind of sacrifice. He's the one that even though he's dead, he still speaks. Enoch, one who pleased God and escaped death as a result, that's Jesus. Noah prepared a means of salvation as well as a means of condemnation for those that reject the salvation. Abraham's a sojourner who left his home to do the will of God, and that's exactly what Jesus has done. Sarah has many offspring that are produced out of the fact that she and her husband are both almost literally dead. Isaac is offered as a sacrifice and then resurrected, like Jesus is, and he bestows blessings. And then there's Jacob giving his blessing while dying on a stick of wood. And what does that do but echo again what Jesus has done for us? Joseph makes arrangements for the Exodus, even in his death, because he trusted in the promise of God. And here's Moses, a special child who chooses suffering, leaves Egypt to do the will of God, implements the Passover, brings about the deliverance at the Red Sea. And Jesus has done all of these things. Jericho, again, a classic demonstration of trust, in which if there is any of story in which the writer is mentioned here, where it's very clearly the people did absolutely nothing to accomplish the result, that's Jericho. Oh, but they marched around the city, and they blew some trumpets. Oh, yeah, that did it. At least to other things like Noah actually built the ark, you know. There wouldn't have been an ark if he hadn't built it, you know, those kind of things. But here you see even, again, what can trust do? Because it's really separate and apart from what the people did with their own physical hands and feet. And then finally, of course, Rahab, salvation even for one who's a sinner and an outcast. And all of these things are pointing us to Jesus. So that when we get to chapter 12, fix your eyes on Jesus. And from beginning to end, he is our demonstration of what perfect faith is. So if there is a hero of faith, it's really Jesus. And it tells us what trust is able to accomplish. What can it accomplish in my life? What can it accomplish in your life? Well, we're going to sing a song now. My Faith Looks Up to Thee, 401. And following this, we'll be partaking of the Lord's Supper. And certainly as we meditate upon the Lord's Supper, we ought to be thinking about this me that we are remembering, this Jesus, the one who lived by trust, and what his trust was able to accomplish with the will of the Father.